Welcome to the Spiritual Activist Radio Show on BBS Radio. And remember, if you ever want to watch the entire interview, you can watch most of my interviews on my website, which is www.spiritualactivist.com. And you can also make a donation there if you care to make a donation, because this is a community-sponsored and supported radio show. Today we're going to be interviewing John Anthony West. And for those of you who aren't familiar who he was basically the person responsible on showing that the pyramids and the Sphinx and the whole Giza Plateau is much, much, much older than we ever thought possible. And we also found out early in this interview that we have a mutual person that we both respect highly, and that's Gurdjieff. Gurdjieff and Ouspensky are some people that have changed the lives and directions of many, many spiritual seekers in the past. And John Anthony West has followed up on a lot of the early research that Swallow de Lubitz did back in the 20s and 30s. So I think you're going to enjoy this interview, because John Anthony West is an academic by default, as he might put it, and he knows just about everything there is to know about the Giza Plateau and some of the ancient ruins and buildings. And he brings to the forefront a lot of the knowledge that has been lost over the centuries. So let's see what John Anthony West has to say for us today. Thank you.
I have a whole lot of respect for your work, your research, and I guess your tenacity too, because in a sense you sort of remind me of Gurdjieff, because Gurdjieff brought a lot of ancient knowledge out, and he was really he really brought it into the forefront, especially through Ouspensky, how important it is to take information and turn that information into wisdom through actually ingesting it and making it part of yourself. And I'd like to set the tone of this interview sort of in that direction, because I think a lot of your information is not just information. A lot of your information, I believe, is instrumental in creating a new world, because basically we've created a world, a civilization, a global civilization, that is so dysfunctional and broken that I don't think, even if we could fix it, I don't think we're smart enough at this level of consciousness to fix it. Because the more information we get, the more it just seems to go in and add to the chaos. And that tells me that we're trying to go from one system to another. And I think that's the importance of what you've been doing in bringing this out, because like you say, the temples are not just a place where teaching takes place. They're a place where it's actually the teaching.
And, that's right.
And I'm curious, how much of the, of what you talk about, how much of the magical Egypt has come to you intuitively by being in these temples, even if you later on validated it through rational research? How much do you think you're affected by walking through these temples?
Oh, initially a lot. I mean, it wouldn't be possible to do it just with your head. It's when you walk into these places. Have you ever been there?
No, I haven't. I'd sure like to.
Well, when you go there, I mean, Goethe, somewhere along the line, talked about architecture as frozen music. And that's not just metaphorically true, it's technically true. Just as music is dependent upon frequencies which have numerical relationships with each other, so the same applies to architecture, except you don't hear it. You experience it because you're in the middle of it. It's like being inside the instrument as the music is being played. So when you're there, you get it, and you get it in a way that it's almost In America, there's almost no such thing because we have no sacred architecture. You get it out in nature or walking in the woods or something like that. But there's almost no sacred architecture in America. You get it in the Gothic cathedrals. You get it in the great mosques. I've never been to India, but I'm sure you get it there in the great Hindu temples there. So it's experiential. Are you, by the way, since you mentioned Gurdjieff and Uspensky, are you in the Gurdjieff work?
Oh, yeah. Matter of fact, most of the books in my background here are either Gurdjieff, Uspensky, Maurice Nicole.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah. I see. Okay. Where are you in a group in England, here in California, or what?
Well, I used to go to some groups down in Point Loma in San Diego.
Mm-hmm.
But most of my study has been by myself, reading, and a lot of it's been through, because let's face it, Gurdjieff was an amazing person, but it took me 3 months to get through Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. it was laborious, you know? So Uspensky really articulated a lot of Gurdjieff's teachings in such a way that I've read all of his books too.
Yes, well, yeah, there's a difference.
Yeah.
Because with Gurdjieff makes you work.
Yeah, he and does.
Uspensky is brilliant. I mean, he really is. You couldn't have a better, let's say, expositor of the doctrine than Uspensky. But reading Beelzebub is in itself work.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
forcing you. I mean, I have, you know, we could do 2 hours if we wanted to on Gurdjieff. But I mean, it's through Gurdjieff, actually, that only because I was deeply involved in the Gurdjieff work for a couple of years already in England, when I was living in England at the time, that I was able to understand Schwalo de Lubitsch, who's impenetrable in a different way. He's not trying to be impenetrable as Gurdjieff is. It's just that his manner of explanation is extremely difficult, like many truly great original minds. Schwal is not a great communicator.
Right.
It just sometimes comes with the territory. So he needs somebody who's somewhere in between. I'm good at that because I'm a writer by trade and a scholar by default. So with Gurdjieff in the back, with Gurdjieff behind me, as it were, or as sometimes like to think at my side, I could actually understand what Schwal was talking about. Those days it wasn't even translated, so I had to read it in my rudimentary French. And so it's only through Gurdjieff that I was able to do anything with that, with Schwaller. But they're basically talking the same language. Originally, I thought, turns out not to be true, since they were in Paris at the same time, that Schwaller was a Gurdjieff pupil. And at some point or another, Gurdjieff said, well, I'm just telling people these things, but you go off there and prove it. It wasn't the case at all, actually. I'm sure they didn't know each other, which is hard to imagine because Gurdjieff was a real presence in Paris when he was there. I mean, he was tremendously notorious.
Especially at the Fontainebleau place and all that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Anyhow, so it was through Gurdjieff that I was able to penetrate Schwaller, and then yes, I completely agree with you that I mean I would hesitate even to use the word civilization for what we're living in now. It's shiny barbarism. It's not fixable because it's a catastrophe from the beginning. Philosophically and spiritually, it's dead. It's worse than dead. It's infected and malignant. There is no fixing it, and it can't be repaired because it's a disaster to begin with. The whole notion of rationalism.
Right. Nor should it be.
No. Yeah. That would be a terrible thing.
How can you have, I mean, I think you could take a 7-year-old with a calculator and tell them, okay, we're going to develop a civilization with a financial institution that's based on infinite growth. If it doesn't stop growing at any point, it'll collapse. And we're going to install it on a planet with finite resources.
That's right.
I don't even think they would have to add it up. They just tell you, no, I don't think that'll work. Yep, but this is what we've done on this planet.
That's right. Or this is what some of us have done on the planet, and
right.
a lot of others have allowed it to happen because they don't know any better. So
yeah.
anyway,
you know, another thing that it was through Gurdjieff that took me to India, and I met a spiritual teacher named Osho. And Osho,
oh yeah, I've heard.
Yeah, Osho is like this. He's a demolition guy. He wasn't here to develop a institution or a following. He told everybody, I don't want any followers. But he was totally out to dismantle organized religions. And that whole movement from Gurdjieff has been so strong in our civilization. And very few people even know of Gurdjieff. It's strange.
Well, actually, it depends what you mean by a few. Relatively speaking, yes. Was Osho Rajneesh?
Yeah, Bhagwan Sri
Rajneesh. Osho's Rajneesh, right. Right, right. Well, very, very similar in outlook, as it were. But Gurdjieff, I think Gurdjieff had a plan. And actually, Osho, did you work with Osho?
Not personally. I just went to the ashram. I was there. And I've been to all of the temples and stuff like Tiwanaku, Chichen Itza, and Machu Picchu, and some of the Aztec ruins through South America. But I've never been to Egypt. But in India, I just spent about 4 or 5 months there at the ashram, just learning how to meditate. Because if you don't embody information, it's just going to stay in your head. And you don't incorporate it. And like Gurdjieff talks about, you have to bring it down and complete that whole octave of assimilating information before it does you any good.
Yeah, exactly. If it's not, to put it bluntly, if it's not a discipline, it's worthless.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter if it's brilliant. It's still worthless. It has to be practiced. And of course, this is what's gone wrong with the world. Religion is something that you do. If all you do is believe and try to force other people to believe what you believe, the whole thing is doomed, and it is doomed.
I wrote a book on beliefs, and the book is about the danger of beliefs as a limiting factor in your neurology. I interviewed neuroscientists and biologists on this, and there's a lot of science behind the fact that if you have a belief, and you hold on to that belief, and it's irrational, it actually filters out other information. And it's sort of similar, like, if I was going to listen to you today and only take your information in on a mental level, it would be like a photograph. But if I don't really ingest it and bring it in, it's the difference between going to a restaurant and reading the menu or going to a restaurant and eating the food.
That's right.
You have to embody it.
But yeah, the practice is, in a sense, is the only thing that counts. And nobody understands anything about a practice anymore, unless you happen to be a professional ball player or a violinist or something of the sort. That kind of discipline, the inner discipline particularly, which is, you know, there's no MVP of the spiritual discipline, as it were. So there's no way to judge. But without that, everything is useless. And one of the frustrating things, I think Gurdjieff himself was, I believe, frustrated at the end of his life that he found so few people who were actually willing to work.
Right.
And one of the things actually, with Egypt, it's the same. I'm sure it's the same in India. It's the same in the Gothic cathedrals. But Egypt is different from any of those places because there's so much of it. And because it operates at such a profound and prodigious level that when you get done with a couple of weeks in Egypt, you really understand viscerally, not just intellectually. Intellectually, you get from the symbolist Schwaller's symbolist point of view, and of course, I mean, with me, even if I'm talking Schwaller, it's Gurdjieff who's my, you'd say, the gray eminence behind me, that everything gets filtered through. But at the end of a couple of weeks there, you really understand what a civilization or what civilizations once were like. And without that, you really don't have a clue. I mean, usually or often I'll start a lecture by gotta get everyone's attention. So I say, well, you know, Egypt is like sex. And then all of a sudden you mention the magical three-letter word. And then I explain that you can read all about it, and that's sort of interesting. And you can look at pictures, and that's graphic and pretty interesting as well. But until you've experienced it, you don't understand anything at all, nothing. And so Egypt is like that. You can read all about it, and you can read my books and things of that nature. And you can look at pictures and beautiful documentaries and so on. But when you're in the middle of it, it has this visceral sense. And since we're talking about Gurdjieff, we know the language. In Egypt, it's unlikely that you go there, at least you don't go there with me, unless you've developed to a certain extent the magnetic center. But when you spend a couple of weeks there, that magnetic center gets very magnetic. People come back out of a trip with a new understanding of what once was. And of course, in a way, it's frustrating because, again, one of the terrible things about Gurdjieff is that once you understand that everyone is asleep, including yourself, the problem of changing anything becomes so gigantic because once you're involved in it, you see how difficult it is to change yourself. And it's so difficult to change yourself in any substantive way, then how is anybody going to change anybody who doesn't already recognize that it has to be changed? And that changing it is a matter of really quite brutal inner discipline, which Gurdjieff himself was a master at applying.
I think I like one of Gurdjieff's analogies where he talks about being in prison, like being asleep. And the first step is to realize you're in prison.
Right.
If you don't realize that, you're walking around feeling free, but you're not. And the second step is to find somebody outside of the prison that, once you escape, can help you stay outside the prison. Because the first moments of awakening are precarious. Like early of a morning when we're waking up from a dead sleep, it's tempting to go back to sleep.
Yes, exactly. Actually, it's funny. I think that analogy, that image, comes from Uspensky. And actually, if I remember it correctly, you can't get out. Actually, the first thing is that you recognize you're in prison, but then you have to find somebody who can tell you to get out, who can teach you how to get out. Because right. you can't get out by yourself. And right. Weirdly enough, when I was living in Spain, when I came across the Gurdjieff work, or when somebody put me in touch with the Gurdjieff work, and I was immediately smitten, bitten by it. And I had a very good friend there, an excellent novelist, a Dutch novelist, and he was writing a novel. He was quite well known back in Holland, and he was writing a novel on exactly this theme of a prison where people didn't know they were in prison, and the music was playing beautifully all along. And I was helping him translate this novel, and as we were working on it, I came across that image, which he didn't know about. It was hard to imagine that he was writing what he was writing without knowing that particular metaphor, right, whatever you want to call it, analogy, teaching tale. But very interesting, because that's exactly the case. Plato's cave is another instance of that. People think they're in the middle of the real world, but they're only getting sort of distorted reflections of the real world. And you do the best that you can in terms of, let's say, laying it out there and saying, this is the situation, this is a sleeping world, and everyone is asleep, no exceptions. Some people are happily asleep and some people are living in nightmares, but all of them call it reality. And so the problem of trying to convey this information, it's not information, of trying to convey the wisdom and the need to practice is extremely difficult. And this is, again, one of the things that Egypt, that these wonderful temples and the artwork does for you, because the words are just the words, but when you're in the middle of it, experiencing it, the words take on a poignance that they wouldn't otherwise have. And that's, of course, to get back to what you were saying, yes, my own conviction is that it's only through the recognition of the importance of this work, not necessarily just Gurdjieff, but you're talking about Osho, or, you know, there are a number of traditions that are still alive and functioning. What makes Gurdjieff different, in my opinion, and really different, I mean, nobody quite like him, and this was what attracted me in the first place, was that I had recognized on my own at a very early age that I'd been born into a lunatic asylum, and it was very difficult living in it. And by the time I came across Gurdjieff, I was still pretty young, 25, 26, 27, something like that. But all of a sudden, I came across posthumously, unfortunately, by a few years, not by that many years. But I finally found somebody who was as contemptuous of Western civilization as I was. The difference was that he knew how to live in it, and that I didn't know. And that's what, I mean, Gurdjieff's doctrine is, I mean, it's a fantastic synthesis of everything that was ever worth knowing in the whole wide world. I mean, over successive generations, told in a way that's always got you on your toes. You never know when he's pulling your leg. You never know when he's got an ulterior motive. You never know when he's deliberately misleading you. You never know. It's, yeah. I think, part of the fun of it.
Which is actually at the basis of a lot of esoteric Sufi teaching.
Right. Well, that's right. Gurdjieff took more from Sufism than he did from, as far as I can see, from any of the other disciplines. But from my personal point of view was that he had a system, a discipline that was designed for the lunatic asylum. None of the other disciplines are designed for the lunatic asylum. Some of them recognize that it's an asylum, but they take you away to an ashram or a monastery or a mosque, a training center, in order to escape the system long enough to at least acquire some level of self-discipline. With Gurdjieff, no, you're thrown to the wolves. You got to do it exactly in the middle of where you are.
Yeah, basically, I think traditional psychiatry and psychology, all they do is they take you back to your cell and rearrange your furniture to where you feel a little more comfortable. And yep. like you've done something, but you're still in jail.
Yeah, well, that's exactly. In other words, the psychiatry, I always used to say about Ralph Nader with his consumer stuff, that he was the guy who was trying to make the locks work better.
Yep.
And that's what psychiatry, most psychiatry and stuff is an attempt to make you happier in your jail cell. And that's not the objective at all. Gurdjieff's whole objective was to make you even more uncomfortable than you were already.
Yep.
But let's face it, Gurdjieff is not for everyone. And it takes, somewhere along the line, he says, you know, you have to be a good egoist before you can be a good altruist. You have to, and I had a teacher, and the guy who led our group when I was in London was a man named Sam Copley, who was a student of Maurice Nicol. And I remember once, he was a good guy, and somebody in our little group wanted to introduce a friend who was deep in psychiatry, of some kind of psychiatric treatment or another. And Sam said to him, no, no, no. He said, this isn't for him. Our job is to bring the subnormal up to normal, not the subnormal up to subnormal.
Right.
So in order for it to be effective or to be valuable, really, it's pretty destructive, in fact. You know, if you're not ready for it, it's hot. And really, anything that's worthwhile is dangerous.
Yep.
Dangerous.
And I think that's why a lot of people don't do the work. Because when you say, I want to wake up, the I that's saying that probably isn't going to be there when you wake up.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So. Yes. Actually, it's funny because we have a good little group here, actually, in where I live near Woodstock, and it's a solid group with a young but a very, very good man running it, and we talk about these things, and if you're into this sort of thing, and you obviously are, you collect stories that are applicable to your own quest. Everyone collects their own stories, and one that always attracted me was a Zen story of a pupil, a young student who goes to a Zen master and says he wants to be his pupil. And the Zen master says, well, what is it that you want? And the student says, I want the truth. You know this one? And
where he takes him down to the rim.
To the rim. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And pushes his head under the water until he almost drowns. And when he pulls him back up and the kid gets his breath back, he said, what did you want when I had your head under the water? And the kid says, air. And the master says, when you want the truth as much as you wanted air, come back to me.
That's true.
It is like that. And anyway, so we've strayed from Egypt, but since it's Gurdjieff and you're a Gurdjieff aficionado or whatever, a Gurdjieffian.
Well, let's get back to ancient civilizations, if you want.
Sure.
One of the things is, let's say, I think you and I have a difference of opinion on ancient aliens. So
yes.
I've sort of suspended that thought and my belief in that because I'm talking to a person, you, that has so much more evidence and information. And I'm curious to see how it is that, because let's face it, we have to explain why and how civilizations have come about and dramatically have collapsed seemingly time after time. And there's only a few things that I think could cause that. One would be asteroids. Another would be if advanced species did help us build it and left and we couldn't maintain it anymore. But I think where you and I might have common ground is in the procession of going to sleep and waking up collectively. Am I correct?
Well, partly, actually. See, I don't dismiss the alien hypothesis. It's just my least favorite hypothesis because I think there are other things that account for it better. The main thing is that there's no evidence as such. I mean, if you're a scholar, and I'm a scholar by default, you need evidence. If you don't have direct evidence, then you need the most plausible explanation. And to my mind, the Hindu doctrine of the yugas, which Plato shares as well with his Golden Age, Silver Age, Bronze Age, and Iron Age, is as good as anything, which is an analogous, let's say, to the seasons of the year, as above, so below, and so on. And so what applies to the annual cycle, at least in theory, could apply to the processional cycle. So just as you're saying, somebody has to wake up at some point or another, well, sometimes it's easier to wake up. If you want to grow roses in June, it's a snap. You just have to go outside and clip them a little bit and put on some bug spray or whatever it is that you do. If you want to grow roses in January, this is a big deal. You have to have special conditions that you have to set up and you have to really want to grow the roses. And to me, that ebb and flow of civilizations is is a perfectly natural cycle. And I mean, this is part of particularly of the Hindu doctrine, where they assign all of these completely extraordinary ages. What is it, 432,000 years is a yuga, and the next one is double that, and the next one is double that again. Well, let's say the archaeological record won't support those kinds of datings, but are you familiar with what's his name, Yogananda's teacher?
Paramahansa, Yogananda's teacher?
No, not that name. Book called The Holy Science, a little book that says that the yugas should be contained within the precessional cycle, the 26,000-year cycle, which is at least manageable. But that's a very plausible scenario to a certain extent, backed up by what we know of history, which after all only goes back in terms of real history to about 3,000-4,000 BC. But even from that time on, for example, in Egypt, you can see that it's forgetting even the Sphinx theory, and that it's much, much older than the Egyptologists think, that it's at its height, as it's at its beginning, and it gradually and gradually and gradually declines until finally it's Ptolemaic Egypt, and then the Romans come in, and then that's the end of it. And then Coptic Christianity rises out of Egypt, but in a, I like to call Christianity at its best, remedial Egypt. It's Egypt for dummies without the science. The science was there to begin with, and this is demonstrable. This you can prove. It doesn't have to come from aliens. I just think it comes from people who, at certain times, were far more both sensitive and intelligent than ourselves, and who acquired this knowledge directly. And there's plenty of evidence, a lot of books in the last few years by very smart guys, demonstrating that the cutting edge of our quantum mechanics and nuclear science and all of that, our cutting edge cosmology is mirrored by the ancients, not mirrored, is expressed by the ancients very precisely, but it's expressed in myth and symbol rather than in mathematical formula that you have to be a mathematician to understand. Myths and the symbols, you also have to have a certain kind of understanding to, let's say, to intellectually understand what they're about, but from the emotional level, you don't have to. You just get it because the stories are so powerful that something inside, something innate, understands that. And you don't need aliens for that.
Right.
I don't dismiss it. And I really do believe, because I'm fairly well up on this, that the alien, the UFO phenomenon is very, very real. It doesn't mean that aliens had to build, we needed aliens to build the pyramids or carve the Sphinx. So, as I said, it's my least favorite of the four possibilities. And we talk about this actually when we're outside the Sphinx on my trips, staring at these extraordinary temples, not just the Sphinx itself, which is pretty amazing, but the temples next to it, which don't get much press, and they're not huge temples like Karnak and Luxor. They're solid structures, but what's remarkable about them is that they're built of these gigantic blocks of stone that weigh upwards of 100 tons and even more, slotted into place like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle. We couldn't do it today without going into a long song and dance about it. Probably we can fly to the moon, so if we had to, or we wanted to, we could figure out a way to build these temples. But as it stands now, we couldn't do it. So when we're standing out there looking at these amazing blocks the size of this room, well, not quite as big as this room, small room, but not that small. I try to break down the problem. I mean, what could be responsible for this? According to the academics, who I like to call the quackademics, there's only one possible explanation. You know, lots of people being very intelligently using very, very, a very primitive technology. And so when you look at these things, particularly get into the pyramids and you look at the King's Chamber and these enormous blocks that are up 20, 20 stories high. You know, how the hell did they do this? But by analogy, I say, well, maybe so, maybe not. If you put a violin in my hands, I will prove to you in about 10 minutes that you can't get any music out of this device. But you give it to a violinist who studied a whole lifetime, and you see exquisite music coming from it. So it's not impossible that the ancients simply were masters of a primitive technology and could do by hand what we can't do with machinery. That's one possibility. Second possibility, this is one sort of what Chris Dunn talks about. You know Christopher Dunn, the Giza power plant? Good guy, Chris. But I think he's wrong about his ancient technology. And he says they could not have done what they did without a truly sophisticated advanced technology from our point of view. The problem with that is that there's no evidence for it. And any our kind of technology requires a tremendously complex supportive infrastructure and a development. I mean, you can't have, I don't know if you know this, there's some hieroglyphs that look like a helicopter, and a bunch of New Age loonies think that this is a helicopter. Well, and it looked like particularly a Russian 1950s helicopter. Well, why should there be only one such hieroglyph? And if there were a helicopter, this requires a tremendous support system of an advanced metallurgy and advanced mining techniques and advanced manufacturing techniques, to say nothing of the aerodynamics evolved and so on. And there's nothing of this, not a bit, none. Again, playing my own devil's advocate, let's say 10,000 years from now, people discover a computer and they're using something, they get power from some other source. They don't understand what this thing is. They think it's a religious device. There's no way for them to know, unless they have some sort of a technology like that, that you can put the whole Library of Congress on the side, you know, on a hard disk inside this computer, which has no moving parts or hardly any. And so it's not impossible that some of the things that we think are religious symbols were actually technology. Not impossible, but I'm not too fond of that one either. Third possibility is that it's a soft technology of some sort. In other words, it's a technology of consciousness. That's the one I actually like, because Tibetan lamas can do things that look impossible. Really advanced martial arts masters can do things that are impossible. Plenty of instances of people in extreme conditions. A woman gets her kid run over with a car and picks up the car and moves it off the kid. We have these capacities within us under certain conditions. There's no commanding reason why you couldn't, or at some point or another, these abilities were trained up, as it were, and suddenly you have 10 or 12 guys at a higher level of consciousness able to move by hand a 100-ton block, or maybe with the aids of music or something like that. So my pet, I can't prove any of this. It's just hypotheses. But my favorite scenario is that it's some combination of one and three, a genius application of primitive or simple technology performed by people at a higher level of consciousness than ourselves. And then explanation four, which I regard as something of a cop-out, is aliens done it. Just because we can't. I'm much more inclined to think, and there are lots of reasons to think that there were people capable of all sorts of things that we can't do. How familiar are you with the Turkish site, Göbekli Tepe?
Just from what you were talking about on that latest series where there's eight series.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. On the Magical Egypt series. Yeah. Well, this, the academics date back to 10,000 BC or earlier.
And why did they bury it?
That's a big mystery. Nobody knows why they buried it. But what it means is that maybe there's a lot of other stuff that's buried. Because when you look at, you would never for 2 seconds imagine when you're driving around there that this hill, which looks like a lot of other hills, has anything in it. So we have all sorts of hypotheses, Robert Schoch and myself, as to why they buried it. I mean, we're not sure. We don't know either. For some reason, it was very important to bury a site that must be, I don't know, 20, 40 acres. That's a lot. It's big. I mean, they've only excavated 5% of this in 15 years of excavating. And what they found is now there are just four, but they know through ground penetrating radar and seismographs that there are another 18 or thereabouts of these closely packed stone circles, like mini Stonehenges, but not so many. The central pillars weigh between 10 and 15 tons, and they're very carefully and precisely dressed and carved in high relief, which means that the surface of the stone has been cut away in order to free the figures that come, as it were, leaping out of the stone. Well, that's 10 times as much work as it is to cut into the stone. And meanwhile, there are no tools. Nobody's found any tools there. So it's assumed that they've done this with flint, but they've not found flint tools either. So this is a gigantic mystery. Schoch and I think that the reliefs, that the stone circles are there because it's astronomical, astrological, cosmological in some sense or another, but we don't know either. All we know is that it's extremely sophisticated, and nobody, including the quackademics, who would love to dispute that dating, are disputing the dating because Klaus Schmidt, the guy, the German archaeologist who's in charge, is a very meticulous worker and not at all alternative-minded or anything like that, but he's careful. And I mean, he's not particularly happy with the astronomical, certainly not the astrological side of things, because he doesn't want to believe, or it's, I won't say it's, that makes it sound as though he's negative about it. It just, he doesn't want to entertain the possibility that there's really a high science behind this.
I think some of the problem with that is we have this biasness for advanced technology being really mechanistic. And I think that comes from the age that we've come through, looking at the nuts and bolts. But who knows? Advanced technology might be something totally, excuse the word, but alien to what we have right now, because it would be psychotronic devices, and it would be things that we can't even imagine at this point.
Not even necessarily devices, but the ability to work with material in a way that we can't do. Look, there's a good friend of mine who died recently, who was the head of the Fortean Society here. You know about the Fortean Society?
No, I don't.
Oh, Charles Fort was an amazing guy who died in the
30s. Oh, yeah, yeah. I got one of his books, Big
Fat Book.
Yeah.
Big book, yeah. He's an extraordinary guy. Anyway, Phyllis, his good friend who died recently, who was the head of the society. There is a Fortean Society, and there's a livelier one in England, following the lead of Fort, who spent his whole life, he had a little bit of private income, enough so that he didn't need a day job, and he spent his whole life combing through the journals. Now it would be easy because you do it on the internet, but combing through the scientific journals and the mainstream journals, looking for stuff that science couldn't explain and rubbing their noses in it. Right. It was great.
Yeah.
Phyllis was a good friend, and I used to lecture once a year or so at the society. And one day we were just sitting and, you know, drinking and smoking cigarettes before I gave them up, and having a dinner, and the subject of spoon bending came up. And I said, well, you know, I never believed the skeptics on it, that Uri Geller and these other people couldn't do it. And she said, oh, of course you could do it. She said, I can do it. And I said, can you really? And she said, yeah, it's easy. Anybody can do it. So I said, well, let's see. And we were at a dinner, and so she had a waiter bring, and this was completely impromptu. There was no setup in this. A waiter brought a thick, she said, bring me a strong soup spoon. So they brought her a soup spoon, and she just closed her eyes and kind of got meditative for not long, a minute or two, and she was just rubbing the spoon like this in front of her, and all of a sudden she went and curled it into a spiral. And I said, and I tried it myself, and I'm not weak. I mean, I could bend the spoon using every bit of strength that I had, but it just curled around as if she had somehow changed the molecular structure of the spoon. Well, if my good friend can do that,
right,
who knows what people who had the training could do. So maybe a lot of these things, they were able to counteract the effects of gravity, which maybe are not fixed in stone, as it were, but are manipulatable by conscious effort. Well, this is one of the reasons why I'm much more attracted by the hypothesis that very advanced, truly civilized people could do these things without needing them to come down from outer space.
Well, I know I don't need to tell you to keep an open mind, because I know you have.
I said it's my fourth possibility, but it's my least favorite one.
Well, I have to admit, the danger of the alien intervention hypothesis is it would tend to keep you from doing further research.
Well, yeah. It will. Yeah. You're basically giving up, and then you have done it further. It takes the question away. How'd they get so smart?
Well, it's sort of like saying God created everything. Okay, now, well.
Well, that's in a way it is like that. Yeah, except, again, God created everything. If you define your terms carefully enough, you could say that that's true. It's just gone in disfavor because of the way, of the people who take that as a given, that there's somebody up there looking like a Michelangelo figure out of the Sistine Chapel, who says, well, what are we going to do today? I think I'll create mosquitoes. No, it can't be like that.
And it doesn't work, because people like you and I, we say, well, okay, who created God?
Yes, exactly.
Then you're going down that rabbit hole. So where do you think we are today, John, in reference to December 2012? Do you think there's anything to that?
Could be.
Yeah.
Hey, who knows? But again, you don't know. Nobody knows how to interpret. The dates seem to be formal, although there are some people who argue and say that they're misinterpreting the dates, and it's not supposed to be December 20th, 2012. It's supposed to be something next year. But that it's a date, that it's a formal date, seems to be the case. But thereafter, since the Mayans don't say, well, this is the day that Walmart's is going to explode, and and there's not going to be any more Twinkies anywhere in the world, since they don't say that, it's open to interpretation. My own sense of it is that, and it's a sense that's been with me ever since I realized I was in a lunatic asylum, was that the whole thing is going under. I'm surprised, quite frankly, that it hasn't gone under well before this, but things kept coming along to rescue it, the digital revolution and the computers and all the rest of the stuff, so that it's lurched along up to this point. But I don't know, do you know who Gerald Celente is?
No, I don't.
Oh, he's a trends analyst, very interesting guy, good friend. And he puts out something called the Trends Journal. We co-wrote a book together in the now out of print, but we're going to put it back into print. Came out in 96, called Trends 2000. And he's got a genius for getting things right. And as I said, I co-write the Trends Journal with him. And if there were no such thing as a Mayan prophecy, just studying the data that we study and watching what's going on in front of our noses would tell us that around now is crunch time. My sense of it is that it cannot go on a lot longer without something pretty drastic happening. Yeah, and
something has to change. And plus there's other research that's been done, like Terence McKenna. He did a whole synopsis on the I Ching and the 64 hexagrams. And before he even knew about the 2012 date, he ran it out, and it also ends on 2012.
Really? Yeah. Got it. Yeah, McKenna's a very interesting guy. He was, of course, deeply into ayahuasca, and I was doing ayahuasca for a couple of weeks down in, a few years ago, down in Brazil, and talking about McKenna all the time. And I think his younger brother, Dennis, is still, and the guy, the fellow who was leading this retreat that I was on, I was there as a guest speaker, was a very, very brilliant guy. And the thing about McKenna, I've read a certain amount of McKenna, but I couldn't understand how anybody could put that much time in, and was that intelligent going through all of these experiences, who remained a Darwinian evolutionist.
Yeah, there's a couple of strange things
disconnect.
About it.
A real disconnect there, that he wasn't thinking it through.
You know, actually, my wife is from Brazil.
And yes?
Yeah, when we were down there, when we first met, we did ayahuasca once a week
for, oh, yeah.
Yeah, 3 or 4 months, you know. But it did. It opened up some inner doors. But again, it's if you don't do the work, it's like if you came to me and you're hungry and I just show you a picture of food, it's not going to do any good. You have to learn how to incorporate that into your being. But
exactly.
It made me really take note of the importance and the validity of the possibility of dimethyltryptamine, DMT, being a spirit molecule, a gateway, a doorway.
Oh, agreed. Absolutely.
But of course, you have to be careful in this because you don't want to promote drugs, just because when people hear drugs, they think of street drugs and everything, but it's totally different than that. You know, DMT seems to play a prominent role in a lot of researchers. I've talked to Fred Allen Wolf, Graham Hancock.
Yeah.
And they all give a lot of credence to this. What do you think about that?
Oh, well, I think to use the image you just used, yes, it opens the door, but you have to then walk through the door. And nobody can do that for you. Basically, you're looking at the food, but you got to get in there and eat the food and actually cook the food and do all of that stuff. Yes, I mean, I know Graham very well. It was through him. And Fred Allen Wolf I met a couple of times. It was through Graham that I got this lecturing thing down in Brazil at this place called, very nice fellow running it, called Luis Eduardo Luna. Running this retreat where people were doing it, and I was doing lectures. I was doing it too, of course, and doing lectures for, you know, just the group of very interested and intelligent people who were Egypt fit into all of this very neatly. But yes, I think Graham thinks that it was the drugs, the hallucinogenic drugs, that made our sophisticated civilizations possible. I'm not so sure. I mean, I think it could be the other way around, that it was possible all along. And as things started degenerating, they needed the drugs in order to do what they could otherwise do anyhow.
Well, you know, I've often wondered that, like in the Bible, it says, on the day that you eat from this tree, the tree of knowledge, you'll know the difference between... Sometimes I wonder if they're not talking about certain herbs and hallucinogenics, because if you were a tribal person that was living out in the desert and had never experienced any other consciousness except taking care of the sheep, and you all of a sudden did something like mushrooms or some hallucinogenic, it would definitely bring you up consciously to another level of perceiving reality, where you would know a difference between good and evil, possibly.
I don't know. I would see that esoterically rather differently, because after all, actually, the ayahuasca reinforced in my mind something that I entertained for quite a while, which was that the ancient people had had capacities that we for the most part don't have anymore. And ayahuasca was a very good example, because, as you know, sure, right? It's two different, completely indistinguished or undistinguished looking plants,
right,
that grow in the rainforest, where there are 90,000 plants of different sorts, and they grow nowhere close to each other. So in order to, and then they have to go through this very elaborate cooking process, in which they're pounded and they're boiled X number of times in a certain way. And it's only by doing that that the stuff works, because one of them has the
inhibitor.
One of them is the inhibitor and one of them is the active agent. Well, in order, you cannot do that by experiment. You can't say, well, boy, guys, let's see what we can get off on here in this jungle full of 90,000 plants. What are we going to start with?
So how do you think they came about this?
So if you want to listen to the rest of this conversation, which we get into ayahuasca and many, many, many other things, you can visit our website at www.spiritualactivist.com. And let's see where this conversation goes. And looking forward to seeing you many, many more times here on BBS Radio. Thank you.